This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we talk to Adrian Ballinger. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Linda.
He's an entrepreneur behind Alpenglow Expeditions and a seasoned climber who has summited Mount Everest 7 times. This last summit was different, and not just because he did it without oxygen. It required a type of training and use of outside expertise that actually changed how he approaches how he manages his business. He'll talk to us about those changes and what anyone can learn. But first, a word from our sponsor. We'll start with a bit of trivia. In 1677, as I'm sure you all know, England passed something called the Statute of Frauds, which insisted that legal contracts must be in writing and signed. Well, that system then moved over to colonial America, and fast forward 3 centuries, we're all somehow doing the same thing on repeat. But at least there's now a better way to do it. Hallelujah. It's called Sign Easy. It's a simple, secure system for your business to digitally sign and distribute documents. You can scan and sign a document, have the system pass that document around to multiple people in whatever sequence you want, track the progress of that document, and even send reminders to the stragglers, the people who still need to put pen to paper, finger to screen. Can you imagine trying to explain this to the Parliament of 1677? Anyway, we today just call it the normal course of business. To get started for free, go to getsigneasy.com/podcast. Hi, Adrian.
How's it going?
Very good. We are very excited to have you, Adrian. Thank you so much for coming.
Absolutely. Really happy to be here.
Awesome. So can you tell us first a little bit about yourself and about Alpenglow?
Sure. So my name is Adrian, and I'm a full-time high-altitude climber and skier. And sort of my passion for the mountains started when I was very young, sort of 11 and 12 years old, climbing in New England, where I was based, Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And I found myself constantly wanting to go to that next higher mountain, higher mountain, higher mountain. And the way that I sort of found my path was through guiding, actually teaching others to climb those mountains as well, and to join me on these big peaks around the world. And sort of the natural progression, if you love high altitude climbing, is you ultimately find yourself on Mount Everest.
Yeah.
I've sort of read and dreamt about Mount Everest since I was 14 years old. I just took in everything I could about the mountain.
Yeah.
But it took me until I was in my, you know, sort of early 30s before I finally got there for the first time in 2008.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. And tell me how sort of Alpenglow Expeditions is a little bit different from some other similar companies.
Sure. So I founded Alpenglow Expeditions in 2004 after guiding for a number of other great companies out in the industry. But what I found is 2 things, really. One, I really wanted to keep my teams small enough that we could feel like a team when we're on the mountain, instead of sort of having a guide that perhaps drags people to the tops of mountains, which does happen sometimes. I wanted to find the balance where each person felt like they had a role in their success, and that takes competency. And so we try really not to rush people to the biggest mountain or the mountain they dream of. Clients often come to us and say, I want to climb Mount Everest, but I've never climbed before. And so instead of just taking them there, we build paths for them where they go to different progressively higher peaks, build skills, and also go through sort of the inevitable experiences where things go wrong in the mountains and learn how to deal with that, take care of themselves, and help everyone get off the mountain safely.
Sure, sure. And so a lot of folks listening to this may not be aware of mountaineering skills that would be very useful and life-preserving.
Yeah.
can you tell me, what are some of those skills that people are learning?
Sure. So, you know, talking about Mount Everest, so Mount Everest is 29,000 feet tall, and we have incredible weather forecasting and things like that that can try to keep people as safe as possible on the mountain. But the reality is, like I said, that things do surprise us up there. And so the skills that you sort of want to have are everything from technical rope skills to be able to manage climbing ropes so as not to fall off the mountain. Yeah. It's very important to have really solid camping skills, actually. Then no matter how big the storm, you can set up your tent. You can keep the tent from collapsing under snow or wind. Yeah. You can cook for yourself inside the tent without burning down the tent, which happens every single year on the mountain.
Oh, God.
Tents get burned down, and then all of a sudden you have no shelter.
Yeah.
So it's simple things like that. And then a very important part is learning your body at high altitude.
Yeah.
So on the summit of Mount Everest, there's 33% of the available atmosphere that there is here in New York City. And that means it is difficult just to survive. And you need to know exactly what your body is telling you while you're up there. And that takes experience.
Sure. And it would also seem to me that that training makes them being busy. Being busy is something that maybe if it is it changes your engagement because you are in it. You're not bored by the silence, by being led somewhere and you don't know why you're being led there, right? Can you talk a little bit about how important that busyness is to someone's experience?
Absolutely. I think it's a great point. I don't think it's just busyness necessarily. There are times where it's like, we just need to be distracted right now. Let's build a snow wall around our tent because we're all kind of scared. And it's like, we can just go out and dig snow for a couple hours and maybe we need to or not. But most of the time, it's like knowing there's work to be done and also knowing where it's leading to, like what the reason for it is. And I think that's part of that buy-in and experience as well.
Sure.
That the things we do on the mountain, they can seem really random and ridiculous sometimes. You know, like, you know, a great example is when we arrive into a camp, we often spend up to 4 hours melting snow for water, not only for that time right then, but also that night and the next morning. And it's kind of mindless work, but it has to get done in order to be prepared to climb the next day. Because if you wake up at 2 a.m. and try to do that melting, it's just too cold and it takes even longer and the stoves don't work and all these different things. And so, you know, sort of understanding what the work is for and what we're working towards, not just the big end goal, but the day by day process as well.
Yeah, working through all that. Working
Absolutely.
Through that. And then, then you do all this, right? And so you have summited Everest 7 times. So for folks who have not summited Everest, I'm raising my hand right now. what is involved in the training and the preparation before you take on something like that?
Yeah, so the preparation to go to Mount Everest is a couple of different sides. One is the experience, which we've been talking about. And so our recommendation, or really our requirement to join our teams, is that you've climbed at least 5 20,000-foot peaks, so lower, and then 1 23,000-foot peak, and then 1 26,000-foot peak, and then you go to Everest. That means you've spent, you know, 60 days on mountains around the world dealing with things that happen.
Yeah.
So there's the experience side, and then there's the physical training side. And we always do, we have a personal trainer on staff at Alpenglow, and they always do an assessment of each client, and then sort of put them on a plan. And we need at least 6 months with our people. And these are people generally who are in very good physical fitness. They have their sports at home, or they use their gym in the city, or they go out hiking and climbing locally.
Yeah.
But it still takes a dedicated focus of time to be truly ready for Everest.
Sure, sure. And in 2016, you wanted to summit, but without oxygen. Tell us just how you even got interested in that particular type of challenge, right?
Sure.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so to put sort of Everest in context of numbers, there's been about 7,000 ascents of the mountain with supplemental oxygen. Yes. So that essentially, imagine a scuba tank, but much lighter.
Yeah.
And we carry those tanks up the mountain, and they essentially add some pure oxygen to the external air that we're breathing to make the altitude feel slightly lower. That's the way the vast majority of people have climbed the mountain. It doesn't make it easy. It's still incredibly difficult. There's still a lot of risk involved.
Yeah.
And all of my summits up until 2016 were done with oxygen.
Sure.
And in my opinion, that's pretty much mandatory. If you're guiding other people, you're responsible for them, you're making decisions for more than just yourself, you've got to be using oxygen.
Yeah.
The whole reason I got fascinated with Everest in the first place is that people are testing themselves to their utmost limits physically and kind of mentally and emotionally. They're pushing themselves to a line where they really don't know what will happen. And then when they're at that line, they still have to make smart decisions, whether it's coming down or going to the summit and things like that, and trying to take care of their teammates. Well, I'm genetically lucky and have so many years of experience that with oxygen, I never found that line. Yeah. I always had more resources to give and to guide. That led me to dream, well, would it be possible to try without supplemental oxygen? And if I do try, will I find that true physical and emotional limit of my own? Yeah. And there's been less than 200 ascents of the mountain without supplemental oxygen. So it's a much, much smaller group.
Yeah, yeah. And so when you first attempted to summit without oxygen, tell me about that experience. What happened?
Yeah. So in 2016, I went back to the mountain. It was my ninth season on the mountain. I still had a commercial team with Alpenglow Expeditions. So we had a group of five members, clients, yeah, along with Sherpa supporting them and other mountain guides. I wasn't officially responsible for that team, but I still found myself getting sort of sucked in. It's my company. It's sure, my, you know, sort of biggest trip of the year. But I also went with my climbing partner, Corey Richards, another fantastic athlete and National Geographic photographer. And we were trying without supplemental oxygen. I had a fantastic season. It was really different to be climbing for myself, yeah, to be climbing up and down the mountain at a different speed than I normally would with my members, trying to spend as much time in front with our Sherpa teammates that, yeah, we could, putting the lines in and setting camps and things like that. So I had a really good season. And actually went into the final summit push confident. So for your listeners, the whole trip without oxygen is about a 2 to 2.5 month long trip. Most, yeah, of that time is spent acclimatizing. So going up and down the mountain progressively slightly higher as your body acclimatizes or makes changes to be able to survive. So you've actually climbed the mountain a lot of times before you make your final summit push.
Yeah.
But on our final push, summit push, 6 days long from base camp to summit, what I found was, I think a number of different things had led into me struggling.
Yeah.
So as I got higher on the mountain, especially above 25,000 feet, I actually had no reserves left. I sort of used every bit of energy I had so that on the final summit day, I couldn't keep my body warm. Yeah. And so I woke up at, or sort of left the final camp at 27,000 feet at 10 p.m., by about 5 a.m., I had been shivering uncontrollably for probably 4 or 5 hours. I was probably only 400 vertical feet from the summit,
yeah,
which is nothing. You know, I could see it. This sort of, you could throw a rock and touch it. You probably could if I had the energy to throw a rock.
Yeah.
But the reality is I was going to get myself killed up there. I had no feeling in my hands to behind my wrists,
yeah,
so I could no longer work the ropes. So I was, yeah, soloing, climbing without a rope with sort, yeah, of 9,000 feet dropping down on the left, wow, side of me to Tibet and 4,000 feet dropping down on the right side to Nepal, sort of wobbling along this ridge.
Yeah.
And the best description is altitude makes you feel drunk is, sure, the only way to explain it, like, yeah, sort of horribly, horribly incapacitated. And I was up there with that feeling, shivering cold. My partner had left me because he was faster, and that was the right thing for him to do, to go at his speed. And I made the decision to turn around that close to the summit, probably 2 hours from the summit after a 2.5 month trip, and came back down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible. And what were you feeling, you know, after that? Like, what were you feeling? What were you thinking?
Yeah, up there in the moment, just like suffering, right? And what I remember of that is actually not a really clear decision-making process. Just, I think maybe it's from having, people say it's a gut instinct, right?
Yeah.
When you make decisions like that. But I think it actually falls back on many, many years of experience, hopefully, that all those checklists I usually use and go, no-go columns,
yeah,
that was probably happening somewhere deep inside. But
yeah,
at the time, it was just like, I'm suffering. I'm going to get myself killed. I need to get off the mountain.
Yeah.
And then after the fact, it was interesting. I came straight here to New York to do media because we had a lot of people following our expedition and things like that. And initially, I just sort of wrote off the climb like, I was too cold. It wasn't my day.
Sure.
Too bad.
Okay.
And that, I think, was a surface. It was an easy story to tell.
Yeah.
But I actually think there was a lot more there. And as I had distance that summer away from climbing, I took the whole summer off climbing. And I started like really trying to look at why I had failed. Because if I ever was going to try again, I didn't want to just do it again and hope I got lucky, like a, yeah, slightly warmer day. I I really wanted to understand it. And I believe no matter how good we are at something, I'm a very good high altitude climber,
sure.
but there are still ways we can improve and get better.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where I dove into this process of really realizing that I really needed to look outside of myself and ask for help.
Yeah. And so who did you ask?
Yeah.
Who on earth do you call?
Right. I mean, the funny thing is, just not that many people have done this, right? And so it's hard to have a big, large body of data of how to climb at Mount Everest without oxygen.
Sure. There's no Google search
on
it.
There's no Google search. But what I knew is I've essentially always trained the same way. I've always eaten the same way. And I've always just been confident that I'm the fastest guy on the mountain. Yeah. Like, I think part of that is ego and part of that is genetic luck, that I do move well at altitude. And so when I look back at my season, one of the things I realized was I was still trying to act on the mountain like I always do with oxygen.
Yeah.
I was trying to do all the work. I was trying to be the first into camp. I was trying to set the tents. I was trying to cook the food. And I had exhausted myself probably long before my final summit day.
Yeah.
So that was part of the puzzle of realizing that if I went back, I needed to ask my Sherpa teammates, my climbing teammate, Corey,
sure.
my expedition doctor, to all help me to do less,
sure.
actually,
of course, yeah.
So I could focus on my own selfish goal. It is a selfish goal, but it's what I had set out for myself. And then the second part was taking a step back and asking for essentially coaching.
Yeah.
So I hired an Olympic Nordic skier coach who works with endurance athletes at a totally different, much more sort of controlled level than climbers do.
Sure.
And it was fascinating.
Yeah.
I went to UC Davis Sports Performance Medical Lab and spent 2 days there being tested.
Yeah.
And literally these guys were able to show me like, you're really strong in these aerobic capacity counts and you're terrible from a metabolic efficiency point of view.
Wow.
You know, point out very specific things. And I completely changed my training. So 60 to 70% of my training for the 6 months before my climb was actually fasted because I didn't need more aerobic capacity. I needed to train my body how to work in essentially starvation conditions because when you're that high on the mountain, your digestive system can't take in food. You can't take in calories.
Yeah.
And it turned out that I was very weak in those metabolically limited conditions.
Yeah.
So a lot of fasted workouts. I actually completely changed my diet. I hired a nutritionist to train my body how to better burn long, slow-burning fats instead of fast-burning carbohydrates and sugars, which is what I've always lived on. I love sugar.
Yeah.
So those were the two biggest things I worked on in advance of the trip.
Sure.
And then on the mountain itself, like I said, like I actually had my guide team just literally not let me dive into the commercial guiding aspect of the team. Because once again, in 2017, I went back and we had a commercial team on the mountain. And my brain as the founder of the company, as the leader, the person people naturally look to on that mountain, I just want to touch everything.
Of course.
I still want to make the little guiding decisions, you know, who's going where on what day. I want to spend hours looking at weather models and I do ridiculous things like organizing, you know, where the ketchup bottle goes on the table at base camp. Things no one cares about, but I care about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no doubt.
And so a big part of it was sort of having, I think, empowering other members of my team to push back on me and help keep me in with the focus that I actually needed.
Sure. And in the training where you're fasting, having these fasted workouts, what does that look like? Can you sort of explain to people what that experience was?
It looks miserable.
Yeah.
At least for a while. A classic workout for me this past winter, I live in Lake Tahoe in California. So some of your listeners might know we had the biggest winter we've had in four decades.
Yeah.
That meant 850 inches of snow.
Yeah.
And I'm a passionate skier, a backcountry skier. So instead of riding lifts up mountains, what I like to do is climb up mountains and then ski down them, which is becoming more and more popular in the States. It's so much fun. It lets you get outside of sort of the resort boundaries into the wilderness, into the nature. So a normal day would be whatever dinner was and then go to sleep, wake up, no food, black coffee still because I love coffee.
Yeah.
So a cup of black coffee and then going out for a workout anywhere from 3 to 8 hours long with no food.
Yeah.
And maintaining very specific heart rate levels. So I'd be wearing a heart rate monitor, trying to stay in a range where I should be while climbing on Everest. So sort of a heart rate, imagine from 140 to 160, no lower, but no higher. And that workout would look like being out in beautiful, snowy Lake Tahoe, climbing up a mountain, skiing down it, and doing it again. But what I found was when I started doing this last winter, I couldn't keep up with my friends anymore at all, without food, without having sugar every 30 minutes, you know, whether it was a goo packet or a shop block or a bar. Without that, the first couple of months were kind of heartbreaking as my teammates, my friends, my girlfriend just left me in the dust and skied all this powder while I'm busy just struggling behind in track. And then it progressively got better and better and better as my body's metabolism started shifting and learning how to work. Because the truth is, we all have incredible amounts of energy stored inside us in the form of fat.
Sure.
We just have to train our body how to use it.
Sure, sure. No, that's amazing. And so you do this for months.
Yeah, 7 months of pretty dedicated training.
Yeah. And when did you sort of start to see a change?
It took about 2 months. And those first 2 months were hard, you know, calling my coach every 3 days and being like, it's terrible. I'm the weakest I've ever been in my climbing career. I've been doing this since I was 17 years old, and I'm just weak, you know? And, you know, him just having to sort of give me that confidence, like, give it time, give it time, give it time. And I actually remember a day in, like, sort of third week of January, we just had storms over and over and over again, and the conditions were amazing. We went out for yet another storm day, and yet again, I thought I'd be left behind, and everyone else would track the powder before I did. And then it was really deep snow and difficult to break through, and so everyone was taking turns. And this was the first time this winter where I could take my turn in front and suddenly keep up and break trail and not blow through my heart rate limits. And it was just like, oh, here it is. And I think we stayed out for 8 hours that day, and it just felt right. And that's when my confidence started to build back up along with this sort of physical training.
And what surprised you about this training experience? What was kind of going through your mind?
You know, really, the whole thing surprised me. I was so sure that I was at the peak of my ability, that I was doing things right. And so there was that side that I was quite confident in what I was doing. And what people had always trained me about alpinism, about climbing mountains, is the person who suffers the hardest succeeds. That's all it's about, is suffering. That's, you read all the books, that's the history, sort of the background of climbing. And this was the opposite. This was like, utilize tools to help you do things smarter. And it is so obvious, but people in the climbing world just haven't thought about climbing in that way. And so that surprised me, that just using data, using science, using Olympic training methods in our sport, it works. And it makes me think about what other people are going to accomplish in the mountains as this becomes more popular. We're going to see speed records broken, enchainments of multiple peaks done. You know, it's incredible. I think the human potential is still to come in climbing.
And so you approach your seventh summit, right? So tell me a little bit about that experience and how it was different.
So I went back to Mount Everest this past spring. It was my 10th season on the mountain. And we arrived in, I think, first week of April, again, for sort of this 2-month-long trip. My partner, Corey Richards, he had actually summited the year before without supplemental oxygen. He did everything right and stood on top in this really proud way. But he agreed to come back just to support me and climb with me and have another season like this. So we went back in, and it really did feel different from the very beginning. The Alpenglow Expeditions team felt really like just solid and confident. And I was able to truly focus 100% on myself. So starting off felt good. But then the next 6 weeks, kind of what I noticed was it just felt the same. And that's one of the hard things, right? All this training, all this work. But the first 6 weeks felt just like they did the year before. They felt great. I was having fun. I was moving well on the mountain. It was hard to know. And I felt this sort of uncertainty sort of building back of leading towards the summit push. Like, what if the exact same thing happens again? You know, once again, we have millions of followers on Snapchat, so excited for the second try. And, you know, all my sponsors have been so supportive to get me back there, and family and all these things have come together to let me be back on the mountain in this quite selfish way. What if the exact same thing happens again? Will I make the same decision? Well, you know, how that will work. So it was actually interesting as I got closer and closer, feeling that sort of nervousness welling up.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. And how'd it go?
Well, I summited and I'm back here with all my fingers and toes, which is very important to me. I've always felt that frostbite, which is so incredibly common on the mountain, there are seasons where up to 10% of climbers get some level of frostbite, which means potentially losing fingers and toes. It went great, but it didn't go easily. The final summit push, I had a lot of that uncertainty and anxiety. I finally rolled into Camp 4 at 27,000 feet, a couple of hours behind my teammate, Corey, who's just a naturally stronger climber than me. And that was sort of one of those sort of emotional battles of being willing to let him go and stick with my training and my pace that my coach had worked so hard on instead of my natural, you know, my natural proclivity would be to stay up with my teammate no matter what. And instead letting him go, getting into camp. And the great thing was I was in that camp at Camp 4 and I wasn't cold. The weather was just exactly the same as the year before. I think the temperature was negative 28 degrees on our summit day, which is a good day on Everest.
Of course,
Even though it's very cold. But I arrived in and I didn't feel cold because I hadn't run down my system in the same way I did in 2016. And that gave me this confidence. But the final summit push was 43 hours long. So 43 hours of no sleeping, sort of just pushing through. And if you ever get a chance to stay up for 43 hours in a row, you know, perhaps you have for other projects. It's pretty amazing. What we have the capacity for. I don't remember a lot of that summit day because when you have that little oxygen, you lose big sections of it. But I do remember sort of like just needing to keep moving forward. The biggest thing I remember is Corey turning around because he was trying without oxygen a second time. And so decided to, he just wanted to see if it was possible to do it 2 years in a row. And he found the suffering to be too great at about 28,500 feet, turned around. And I remember just being crushed that we weren't going to summit together. That was always one of the big goals. The wild thing was he got a few hundred feet down, met some other members of the Alpenglow Expeditions team who had supplemental oxygen and masks with them, took a set, and came back. And that's my single greatest memory from the mountain, not the summit, but it was seeing Corey come back, like high-fiving, yelling, dancing around me, because he can run circles around me once he's on oxygen.
Of course, yeah.
And just feeling that like rejuvenation of energy and realization that we could do this together. It was the single highlight of my trip. And we stood on top together at 10:53 a.m. on May 27th.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And so you come back, you know, and this experience of seeking out experts, of finding ways to, you know, let other people, you know, take up what you would naturally try to fill, the gaps you naturally fill. How does this change? How is your sort of your workflow different, your approach to your day different? Tell me a little bit about that.
I think it's funny. I approached my business in very much the same way that I've always approached Mount Everest, which is like, I'm in front and I'm running. And even the things I don't have the greatest expertise of, whether it's web design or marketing or, you know, accounting, I try to get my hands in and mess with things and be in front. And what Everest in this process taught me is right from the beginning to sort of step back and look bigger and allow other members of my team to sort of step up and try things, even when they don't necessarily sound to me like the way I've always done it or the way that I think makes sense. Just taking that extra breath, that extra like moment to give opportunity. I've just seen my team, number one, so much more excited and engaged. And number two, I'm seeing things work that I didn't think would work.
Of course.
And that's just really exciting to me. And it's giving me the opportunity as well to sort of focus on the areas where I'm most passionate or best at, where I should be in front instead of where I should be getting out of the way.
Sure, sure. And how do you do that, right? So a lot of people listening to this, they hear you empower your team,
yeah.
right? And so if you've not done that, if you've not experienced that, you might think, well, I don't know, I told them to do it. I don't know, they have everything they need.
Sure.
So what's the problem, right?
Yeah.
You know, so how do you do that? What's your strategy? What's your approach to make people comfortable taking that step?
Yeah, I think a big part for me has been the pre-planning of it. So instead of just being in the weeds, on fire, like, you do your job, go, go, go. Mm-hmm. One of the things we've instituted is every single month now, we have a half day with the whole team outside of the office, sort of like just talking big picture. Instead of the problems and the issues, big picture. What's working? What's not working? What are our goals? And are we doing the work that leads us towards those goals? And so having those meetings, I think, has given everyone a better sense of what that big picture is. Mm-hmm. And it gives me sort of the confidence that I need to let go some. Whereas when it's in the moment and there's a fire, you put it out. Mm-hmm. And that's when it's that much harder, I think, to really give that space mm-hmm. that people need.
Yeah. And is there also sort of a change in the way you have to structure a conversation? So instead of saying, you do this or I want that, that it's, well, what do you think of X? What would you do? You know, changing that paradigm a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. That there's, in communication as a leader, it is so easy, especially since I've been in the business. You know, I've had Alpenglow now for 14 years. I've been guiding in the mountains for over 20 years. And some of my teammates in Alpenglow, they haven't been in it that long. So it is very easy to communicate like, do this, do this, do this. And it has taken a shift to sort of step back and let other people's ideas percolate up. And instead of just saying, do what the task is, what I think the task is, instead sort of stating the problem or the goal or what it is we're trying to achieve. And then letting other people fill in what the tasks are to get there. Mm-hmm. And often those tasks are different than what I expected.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's really interesting. And also, I think that what's fascinating too is this element of you felt that you were at the peak, you know, and no pun intended, you felt that you were at the peak of your sort of climbing ability, but you realized that you were not, right? I think a lot of people might feel that in their career or whatever, like, I know my job. Mm-hmm. I know how to do it. I don't, what else on earth is there for me to learn? But it's that realization that there is something else that you don't know that you can push towards. I think that's really interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about like how important that realization is?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is so true in all of us, right? Like what you just said, like, I know my job. I felt that so clearly. I know how to run a guide company. I know how to climb mountains. I was sure of it. And I certainly didn't think something like nutrition, which, you know, it's always sounded like, I think diet, right? I think like, you know, it's just not my world. And yet it was something that could help so much and make me so much stronger. And I think that's probably true for all of us in whatever we do, especially when we look outside like our wheelhouse, like the things we know and we've been training with for years. Let ideas come in from complete left field. And yeah, I believe human capacity and just about everything we do can go further. You know, the whole idea of the 2-hour marathon is such a great example of that. Something that truly seems so impossible. And yet the little bit about I know about it now it seems 100% possible.
Yeah.
Things just keep, there's always more capacity, I think, in humans for achievement.
What helped you sort of find both the answers for your training, but also the lead you down the path to the fact that you had more potential? What do you think that is in you that helped you kind of keep poking around and keep pushing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm lucky to be surrounded by people who do sort of inspire me in many ways to be open to that. So Corey, my partner, was certainly part of that. Yeah. Like, you know, Corey, I'm always the faster climber than Corey in our partnership.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yet up high on Everest, it's like he takes off his Clark Kent sunglasses, you know, glasses and throws on his cape and becomes a superhero. And like watching him achieve something that seemed so far beyond actually his like training and normal capacity was like, like there's something there. There's something that I need to figure out how to harness. So there's inspiration there. And then really coming home, my girlfriend, Emily Harrington, is also a professional climber. Yeah. And she, on a regular basis, exceeds like what seems physically possible. She's a rock climber.
Yeah.
And just keeps getting better and better and better. And she is this just like deeply self-honest person is the best way I could sort of describe it. She really is able to look into herself, find these weaknesses, and figure out how to make herself stronger. And she was really the one when I came home encouraging me to like look deeper than it was too cold.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that's the excuse. So that's the in the moment reality. But what led to that place?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think having those people in our lives that sort of encourage us to push deeper, to look further, and to challenge ourselves or our you know, our normal ways of working or thinking. So whether that's a mentor or a friend or a family member, I think having those people around who challenge us.
Sure, sure. And is it also sort of looking beyond the immediate feeling that you had, right? So I'm cold, I'm tired, mm-hmm. whatever. Oh, I couldn't do it because whatever, I just was too exhausted, right? Looking beyond that and asking yourself like, okay, well, why did I get to that point, right? Like not seeing the feeling as the answer.
Absolutely. And I think for me, there was really an ego piece involved as well in that, you know, I found myself that I wanted to have this neat story with a bow on it that I could tell my sponsors and tell in interviews. There was like, you know, it was too cold. I was going to get myself killed up there. So I had to come down. That almost sounds like a heroic story. Like you made the right decision in a really hard situation and it allowed your partner to keep going instead of Corey having to come down and rescue me. He got to go to the summit. So when I came home, it was so easy to sort of stay stuck in that like convenient story. But I wouldn't have learned anything out of that. And so it took sort of that next step of being willing to be like, no, actually what this was a personal failure. This was a failure in my training and in my strength. And that's okay. We all fail. We all fail all the time, right?
Yeah.
But how often do we actually stop, acknowledge those failures, and really figure out what we can change? And that's what was different for me. And I directly feel like it led to this success.
Yeah. And I personally feel like, too, that there might even be sort of like a silent failure. So most people listening to this aren't going to have a very obvious experience where they tried to summit Mount Everest and it didn't work out, right?
Yeah.
So that's very clear. Okay, I tried and it didn't work out, you know, whatever. But I think that the idea, too, that you could maybe not realize your own potential and just that idea of not thinking about it, I feel like it's its own failure. So sometimes failures also don't come to us wrapped up in a bow, right?
True, yeah.
You know, which I think is also sort of another interesting realization. What advice do you have for other people, right, who want to do more, want to realize their potential, and want to do just what you did, which is sort of like use the people around them to build everyone up? Like, what do you suggest they do, and what should they be thinking about?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest way is to flip it around and do it for other people.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's part of something I'm quite conscious about, especially now, is each of us have these goals, right? Whatever those goals might be, in work, in personal lives, in play. And if you can find out what it takes to support someone you love or someone you work with to achieve what they're working towards, you're going to see what things help them. And I think a lot of times from outside, it's easier to see what someone needs than when you're in that moment yourself.
Yeah.
And so I think working through it with someone else, helping them to achieve a goal that's important to them, it also helps to then know, well, maybe this is something that could help me. Maybe I can ask for that.
Yeah.
Or I don't know what I need, but I know this person knows me really well and they're on my team or they're working towards, you know, and so you know what to ask or at least who to ask to help you.
Sure, sure, and that dialogue has started.
Absolutely. I mean, the communication piece for me has been so essential in opening up to what my weaknesses are, asking for help in those areas, even as the leader.
Yeah.
And it's really changed my office and it's changed my guide team. You know, I work with 24 guides around the world, both locally in Tahoe and then internationally. And I think my experience on Everest and them seeing that and us talking about it, it's just changing how our team is communicating.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing it, you know, in Ecuador and in Tahoe, just all of us maybe being a little more stoked, a little more excited, and being more successful.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Adrian, this has been wonderful. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have. But thank you very much for your wonderful storytelling and for your experience. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Linda. Yeah, it's fun.
This has been wonderful. And so that is our show. How Success Happens comes out weekly. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And don't be afraid to leave us a review. It helps us improve and reach more listeners just like you. And for more stories just like this one on the mindset that you need to start and grow a business, go to entrepreneur.com. And to let me know what you think about this show, find me on Twitter at Linda Lacina. That's the @ L-I-N-D-A-L-A-C-I-N-A. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.